Welcome to the Logic Consortium. This is your host, Briskovich, and today we're talking with one of Israel's most famous and most controversial historians. We're going to be talking about his book, The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1947 to 1951. We're going to be talking about the lead-up to the war, its aftermath, Professor Pape's views, and the idea that people's views about the Arab-Israeli conflict today have so much to do with their account of the events of 1948. And we're going to be trying to have people with distinctive views and distinctive accounts on the show in the upcoming weeks. So thanks so much for listening, everyone. Please stick around. Before talking about the war, as discussed in the book, I wanted to talk about the lead-up to the 1948 war. Your book emphasizes a lot of the politics in the lead-up to the 1948 war. For example, the influence that the Soviet Union had on a lot of the process and the huge Jewish diplomatic preparation. Can you talk about this a little bit?
Yes, definitely. I think a good starting point is February 1947, when Britain decided to end the mandate that was given to her by the League of Nations and to cease its rule over Palestine and refer the question to the United Nations. The moment this decision was made, the game was open. And everyone who had a stake or an interest in controlling Palestine had to move into action. The most effective action, if you want, was taken by the Zionist leadership. They was better prepared than anyone else for that eventuality. And they decided almost immediately after it was clear that Britain was going to leave that they would make a military effort. So that was in many ways the Jewish side. The United Nations, on the other hand, wished to offer kind of a business-like solution, suggesting without a lot of knowledge of what was going on there to divide the country into two states. The Zionist leadership was not excited about it, but they knew two things. One, that there's no chance that the Palestinians, as an indigenous native people, would ever accept the losing half of the country to a group of settlers. And secondly, that they would have the military power to change the kind of offer that, in principle, they have accepted. I think what really interested the Zionist movement was that the United Nations, which became the solution, became the famous petition resolution, adopted in November 1947. They understood that that resolution granted the newly born Jewish state international status, and that was very important. The Arab world was too busy, in most cases, with its own liberation war against European colonialism. The only country that took very seriously what was going on in Palestine was Jordan. And they had a tacit understanding with the Jewish agency that after the British left, they could have a small part of Palestine in return for very limited participation if indeed the Arab world would go to war against the new Jewish state. And this little part of Palestine was the West Bank, which was annexed without one shot to the Jordanians in that war. The Egyptian society wanted the government to take a far deeper role in this. The government didn't want to, but the pressure from below forced the Egyptians eventually to send a sizable number of troops into the battlefield, or to take the lead in deciding for the Arab world that the Arab world would oppose by force the idea of the creation of a Jewish state.
And one thing that I heard you say that I thought was really interesting was talking about the first Zionist settlers, and that they were really aiming to build an infrastructure. And they didn't really think about the question of where the Arabs were going to live until the immigration through and after the 1930s. And the idea, and you talked about leading to this was the fact that no more land could be bought up.
That's right. So let me recap that in my own words. But that's definitely true. I think it's important to understand that the number of settlers who arrived initially in Palestine in the late 19th century and up to the time that the Holocaust begins, in a way, 1940, something like that, the number of settlers was very small, and it was still a very volatile situation for the Jewish community of settlers. And therefore, the preoccupation of the leadership was not so much what would be the fate of the indigenous native people of Palestine, but far more what would be the fate of their own community in terms of building an infrastructure for economic independence and political recognition within the world of the British Empire. And once that was secured, and more or less when the Jewish community became one-third of the population, which happened in the late 1930s, then a more serious focus began to be to appear on the question of the future of the Palestinians, and the early thoughts of ethnic cleansing appeared in earnest in that period.
And moving on to the war,
yeah.
As you mentioned, much of the contention surrounds the question of responsibility for the displacement of so many Palestinians. And then much of the debate centers around the exodus after March of 1948.
That's right.
And in the book, you lay out a few arguments that people give. So let's, before, there was the argument that David Ben-Gurion gave, saying that there was a directive from the Arab leaders who told the Palestinians to leave. And then after some research, Benny Morris said, no, there were never explicit instructions. And there were dispossessions, but not under a specific master plan. And then some Arab historians, like Walid Khalidi, says that there was a master expulsion plan, and this plan was Plan Dalit, Plan D. Can you talk about all this a little bit?
Yes, definitely. I think we have three tiers here, three stages, in a way that we begin to we understood as historians how this all unfolded. The first stage was when, on the one hand, you had the Israeli official position, which claimed that the Palestinians left voluntarily and that they obeyed by this orders by Arab leaders from the outside to leave, to make way for the invading Arab army with the promise to come back when victory is achieved. This was, I think, quite successfully debunked by the group of historians called the New Historians, including myself in the 1980s. But of course, the most important work in this respect was Benny Morris's work, The Birth of the Refugee Problem, where he showed that, A, there were no such calls from the outside, and B, that there were at least extensive orders to expel people, although he didn't think that Plan D at the time was a master plan. However, when the Palestinian historian Walid Khalidi received a translation from Hebrew to English of Plan D, he, and to my mind rightly, said it is far more a master plan than referred to in Benny Morris's writing. But the debate continued. What I contributed is the fact that after Benny Morris's book appeared, the Israeli IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, released in the late 1990s new documentation. And there we realized that there were two kinds of Plan D. There was one small document, which both Walid Khalidi and Benny Morris related to, which summarized some of the main instructions in Plan B. But then there was a cluster of thousands of orders which also come under the heading of Plan D, which were published a bit later after the official publication of the plan. And that, if you want, informal Plan D, was very comprehensive. It divided Palestine to zones, and in each zone a military unit was ordered to expel more or less everyone who lived in those zones. And that was why I decided both to write the book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and also felt very confident when I state in the beginning of the book that Plan D was the blueprint and the master plan for the expansion of the Palestinians.
What can we draw from the history of the war to help us move forward.
Yes.
Today in the process. I mean, yes. I know you talk about mutual recognition helping to solve problems.
Yeah, definitely. I think that what happened in 1948 deserves three references today. The most important reference is acknowledgement. I mean, it would be very difficult for any Palestinian leadership or any group within the Palestinian community, whether they live in the land or they are refugees or they live in exilic communities around the world, to move forward to any genuine reconciliation as long as official Israel denies the crime its army perpetrated against the Palestinians in 1948. That's the first, my first conclusion today for what happened. Secondly, I think there's a question of accountability, and I think the Israelis have to be accountable for what happened. And the best way of, I think, solving this issue, accountability, so they would be translated to something positive that would enable reconciliation, is to accept, at least in principle, the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. I understand that eventually this right has to be negotiated and has to be implemented practically, and there will be a long process, as in other places in the world, where return of refugees was negotiated. But at least there has to be a principled acceptance of the right of people who were kicked out unjustly from their homes to go back, if the homes exist, or to go back to the near to where the homes used to be, or compensate it if that's what they want. Yeah. And in fact, there is a very clear United Nations decision, decision 194. From 11th of December 1948, that states that this is the right of the Palestinians, both their individual rights and collective rights. The third thing, and I think many people should understand this, that because 1948 is not acknowledged by Israel, and because Israel is not accountable for what happened in 1948, ethnic cleansing continues since 1948. As we speak, today people are kicked out from their houses in the south of Israel, in eastern Jerusalem, in the West Bank. And I think that as long as these acknowledgement and accountability questions are not solved, there is no inhibition for Israel to continue in other means and in a much more limited significance, if you want, the policy of ethnic cleansing.
And you say that Palestinian aspirations of a solution today are still so strongly associated with these events and consequences of the war of 1948.
Yes, and even more so. You know, people keep saying that, and that's true, but I think it's part of the story. Namely, it is absolutely true that this is the heart of the Palestinian demand, and without an equitable solution in their eyes to the refugee question, there's no chance for a comprehensive solution. But I think it's also a very interesting and an important Israeli problem. I'll tell you why. The main Israeli objection to the return of the refugees is that Israel wants to keep by every means possible a Jewish majority in the land. And therefore, negotiating with Israel over the right of return is also negotiating with Israel over its ethnic nature as a state. And I think that the one would lead to the other. In other words, once the Israelis would really aspire to be the only democracy in the Middle East and would not deem democracy as something which is exclusively granted to the Jews in a kind of a semi-apartheid state that which they have, once this would be done, I think it would be much easier to solve the refugee problem. Israel is getting immunity from the world, especially from the USA, as being the only democracy I know which is allowed to say I am democratic as long as I have a Jewish majority. Namely, that my own citizens, if they are not Jews, cannot be part of the community. Imagine this being said on Jews or African Americans or Hispanic citizens in the United States. It would create an outrage. That would be the American position, that only whites can form the body which is allowed to take decisions in the United States.
One thing that I heard you say recently that I thought was interesting was there's this tension between the idea of the miracle of the state of Israel with
the idea of displacement
of other peoples, and that this tension really needs to be overcome for us to make advancements.
Yes, definitely. I think only someone like me who was born here can say this thing, because I feel through my experience in childhood and through my life here how wonderful actually one side of Zionism is, whether it's by saving Jews around the world, by reviving the Hebrew language, by creating a vibrant, exciting place, and so on. But I think I'm one of the few Israeli Jews who understands that this was achieved in a very high price, and the price was the dispossession of the Palestinians, not only in 1948, the continued dispossession of the Palestinians. And I don't believe that these things have to be incompatible. I think you can still enjoy a very good life here, but you have to give up the racist notions that this is just a place for Jews alone. This should be a place where everyone is equal, whether they are Jews or Arabs, whether they're Muslims, Christians, or Jews. And I think that dream of equality was never part of the Zionist movement. And because of that, it became a colonialist and a racist project rather than a process of democratization and liberation of people. And I think that's what I meant when I said these things.
You said that society in Israel was more receptive to your views during the intense peace negotiations of the late 1990s. With these new peace murmurings in Israel and Palestine, are people listening to you more at all?
No. Actually, this more open period ended already in 2000 with the outbreak of the second uprising, second Intifada. There was a kind of U-turn, a retraction of all the critical talk that was in the academia or in the press or even in the Ministry of Education. This is all over now. In the last 11 years, the Israeli society has moved to what we call here the rights of to the right pole of politics, which means any notions that you can talk in any critical way or in any open way on formative chapters in history such as 1948 is regarded as treason now. So people don't dare to do this even if they want to do this. So I think we are back to the official version of 1948, and there is very little hope, at least in the near future, for any critical discussion of Israel, either of the policy of the state in the past or the present policies of the state against the Palestinians.
And just kind of finishing up, you do talk about this role of this pragmatic dove in the
yes.
book. And one example you give around the time was this Moshe Sharet. And can you talk about this role of the pragmatic dove and how maybe it could help us overcome?
Yes, I don't think I describe or depict the pragmatic doves as people who have the key for the future, but they are interesting phenomenon. You have to understand there is a Zionist mindset, and within that mindset there are definitely debates, but I would call them tactical debates. Namely, Sharet, who was the first foreign minister of Israel and the second prime minister of Israel and one of the leaders of the Zionist community in Mandatory Palestine, did not question the basic fundamentals of Zionism. Namely, he did not oppose the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. However, after a small Palestinian minority was left in Israel, he negated the idea that these people should be under military rule, and he was willing to give them equal rights. However, I'm sure, had these people grown in numbers, he would object to these equal rights. So, in fact, maybe I'm not even saying it in so many words in the book, because this is something I developed after the book was published. Sorry, there's an aeroplane flying next to my phone. The pragmatic doves are helping Israel to look more humane and more normal in many ways. And in many ways, these are people who are moderate in a way. But when it will come to the moment, to a crucial moment of war or peace, or of what the Israelis would perceive the extreme growth in the demographic numbers of Arabs inside the Jewish state, these people would forget their pragmatism and forget their dovishness and would not help us in preventing the possible next chapters in the Zionist dispossession of the Palestinians. So, although I have admiration for people like Charette, and definitely I depict him in the book as someone that had a better understanding. He also spoke Arabic, which the others, some of the leaders of Zionism, didn't. I still don't want to give the impression that this is enough. Even people like Charette today have to walk an extra mile to enable us to come to peace and reconciliation in Israel and Palestine.
Well, maybe in my lifetime we'll see somebody in that role take the extra mile. Well, Professor Pape, thanks so much for coming on our show today, and maybe someday in the future I could have you on for a discussion with somebody else.
I would be very happy to take part in it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on your show. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay,
thank
bye-bye.
You, bye-bye.
You're listening to The Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with Israeli historian Ilan Pape about his book, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1947 to 1951, which we read here on The Logic Consortium, and we really tried to bring out some of the issues that he thought was are central to the current debate. We, well, thanks so much for listening. You can find our past shows at logicconsortium.blogspot.com. We got, we just read here on the Logic Consortium, The Palestinian War, 1948, by a right-wing Israeli historian, Ephraim Karsh, and I am asking him to come on the show to maybe challenge some things that Professor Pape just said. And upcoming, we're going to be speaking with Professor Economist Paul Collier about his recent book, The Plundered Planet. So we got a lot of things in the works here. And send us an email if you want to suggest a topic, or if you want to even, you know, come and help me interview somebody. Because I'm sure there's a lot of comments from what went on today. This is The Logic Consortium. Have a great day.